Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on June 6th at around 4 a.m. in the morning here in Spain. This is Nav Briefing number 11, which I'm entitling The End of Humanity. I thought I would take the occasion to pick up on some remarks I made regarding hatred in a previous briefing. It occurred to me that those remarks could have come across a little bit skewed. So I'd like to restate my views on that highly charged issue of hatred. First of all, certainly by assuring you that hatred in the form that it's usually expressed by human animals is nasty and ugly. And I'm certainly not into nasty and ugly. So as far as my experience and my definition of hatred are concerned, I'm not suggesting anything of the sort in that direction. I suppose that when I use the word hatred, it would perhaps be equatable to something like a cold, clear fury or rage, a sober rage. So this is not an agitated, rabid dog kind of hatred that I refer to. But it is a hatred directed toward certain objects or certain topics, you could say, certain issues such as tyranny, lies, manipulation, deceit, secrecy, and toward the people who exhibit those behaviors. So while on the one hand, if you want to be delicate about it, if I were to be delicate about it, I would say, well, yes, I hate the behavior of lies and secrecy. I feel a cold, furious rage against that kind of behavior. And that would be the nice way to put it. But in a more ruthless way, in a more Kali-esque way, I would simply say, yes, I also hate the people who exhibit that behavior of lies and secrecy. Nothing personal. It's not as if I would hate them personally, but I would hate them as one human animal to another for exhibiting that type of behavior. So I have a little more to say to this, say on this as this briefing unfolds, and also some further comment and qualification on my remark that humanity is finished. Hence, I've titled this briefing, The End of Humanity. I'd like to dedicate the greater part of this briefing to a kind of corrections and directions. That is to say that there's a few points in recent briefings which I'd like to correct. And then I would like to set the direction of our discussions and explorations in the process of correction that are now unfolding as we come up to the midpoint of correction, which would be in August of 2012. Around May 27th, we entered the sixth second of countdown, regarded in aeonic terms. So until that point, the countdown had been 10, 9, 8, 7. Currently, correction proceeds in the sixth second of Sophia's own timing. And of course, when we come to the fifth second, in August, we are at the midpoint. As regards corrections, I'd like to say that in the talk in which I mentioned the Apocrypha of John, I said that there are three drafts of this cosmological text in the Nag Hammadi collection, which is true. The fourth parallel draft is actually from another document called the Berlin Codex. There are some parallelisms in the writings of Irenaeus that refer to passages in the Apocryphon of John, but the fourth document is actually another Gnostic document known as the Berlin Codex, which was discovered in the 19th century, I believe. Also in that talk, I said at one point that I was regressing when I actually meant to say I was digressing. I'd also like to point out to you regarding the Fourth Lateran Council, I don't know if 1215 was exactly the date. It was the date I heard from the Rotama, strangely enough. But I think it was actually 1215 or 1214. If any of you want to delve a little more deeply into that particular topic, I suggest that you look into Creative Mythology by Joseph Campbell. In his discussion, it's one of the volumes of The Masks of God, which is a four-volume work of Campbell. He discusses the dogma of transubstantiation and the Fourth Lateran Council at some length. And he does it in relation to the story of Parsifal, especially the Wolfram von Eschenbach version, which was being written at that very moment. And Campbell is quite explicit in referring to satanic or black magic as being as the element that came into play at that moment in history in a quite remarkable way. And he relates the leading papal figure of the time to the figure of the evil magician Klingsor in the Parsifal legend. Looking back for a moment to NAV briefing number 8, which was titled Rounding Cape Fear, there are a couple of corrections or clarifications that apply to that recording as well. Also, perhaps a kind of mix-up or point of confusion that I really need to clarify as much as possible. You of the Gaia Navigation Experiment will observe that in my current briefings that I've resumed after a lapse of about 6 weeks, I am referring to Kala Tantra and some Kalika Tantra practices. This may seem to be going against the guidelines that I set a while back. Remember that I established a firewall between the material pertinent to the Gaia Navigation Experiment specifically and material thoughts, teachings, and practices specific to Kala Tantra and Kalika magic, and I made a strong point about that firewall. After all, the fact is that those of you in the Gaia Navigation Experiment didn't sign up for Kala Tantra, so I ought not to be propounding or teaching Kala Tantra in this context, and I won't. I guarantee you that I won't be disclosing any of the practices or techniques regarding Kala Tantra in these NAV briefings or in the crew notes. But I will occasionally refer to the subject of Kala Tantra, and I have to, because in my own experience, it's rather difficult to separate these things. Teaching the Gaia navigation experiment is the role of the nav, and transmitting Kala Tantra is the role of the Nahual. And since I hold both those roles right now, I tend to sometimes mix them up. But there are some aspects of Kala Tantra and Kalika magic which obviously do not belong in the Gaia navigation experiment so far anyway. So far. I would have to add that caveat. What's become clear to me over the last 6 weeks, when I've received quite a lot of Kalika instruction, is that there is a shift ahead. There's a turning point coming up real soon in this experiment. What I've realized that this turning point is that this turning point is probably located around the midpoint of correction. And so the very process of correction would engage its participants in a different way in the second half of correction. In the first half of correction, which is just now concluding, we are witnesses to the Nahual of the Wisdom Goddess, and we are observers and witnesses, those in the crew. When I say we, I mean those of the crew, not humanity at large. But in the second half of correction, there's a shift from witnessing and observation to action and participation. So it appears to me now that Kalika magic is an extremely pertinent and potent form of participation in the correction of the Wisdom Goddess. So it may be more and more difficult for me to separate out Kalika magic from the Gaia navigation experiment as such. So I ask for your patience and understanding on that point. Also, in reference to nav briefing number 8, rounding Cape Fear, I said that I would be uploading another talk on the Hetaira, called Hetaira Watch, but I actually didn't like that, the way that particular talk came out, so I took it off. Some of you may have picked up on it during the day or so it was on there. I don't really have anything more to say right now about the Hetaira. Also, I'd like to point out that, remind you that we use the concept of a demasking process for the positioning of the lunar apogee before the satanic head of Cetus. And we have the one of the focal points of the experiment for several months now has been the demasking of evil and the stall of the apogee before the mask of Cetus represents the last phase of that process. The apogee is just coming out of the stall as I speak. I don't know how the rest of you are feeling and sensing this, but I am feeling an enormous sense of relief. And for the first time, really feeling a lot of oppression and desperation that occasionally mingled into my soul life being dispelled. I would summarize it by saying that with the shift of the lunar apogee away from the face of Cetus, with it coming out of the stall through this month, and more so through the month of July 2012, that the spell of fear on this planet would be dissolving. That is to say, not for everyone on the planet, but for those who really don't want to live in fear, for those who have really made up their mind that it is completely unacceptable to go along with all the insane fear-mongering that happens on this planet 24 hours a day, every minute of every day, not only through the mainstream media, coming from the government and who knows where else, coming from the command and control level of the perpetrators, but also from the alternative media and the internet. There's a huge amount of fear-mongering going on among those very people who purport to be exposing and opposing the powers that be. And I don't know how the rest of you feel, but I'm really sick and tired of living in this miasma of fear constantly and of sucking in the confusion that comes from the fear, the confusion and uncertainty generated by this fear. And so you could say that one of the proofs that the experiment is working, that the experiment is succeeding, and I want to talk more about the success of this experiment right now. One of the proofs is that you would feel yourselves becoming immune to this spell of fear, even though it is still being conjured up in the world around you, in the social world. It may not be reaching you anymore in the way that it has before. And this would be a tremendous sign of a positive and successful development and correction. Something I mentioned in NAB Briefing 9, or 8, excuse me, concerns the character played by Robert De Niro in Scorsese's film of Cape Fear, which was a remake of an earlier film with Robert Mitchum, was that De Niro, the psychopath De Niro, is no different from the other globalist psychopaths who are running the nightmare game on this planet. Well, that's not true. Actually, a psychopath like De Niro is someone who confronts his victims and who interacts with his victims. And the mark of the globalist predators at the command and control level is that they never, ever do that. The only case in which a globalist perpetrator, such as the President of the United States or the head of some nefarious corporation or some banking cartel, banking mafia, the only instance in which someone in those ranks would confront a victim is if that victim were brought to them in a drugged and helpless condition, as apparently does occur. If you believe the claims being widely spread on the internet that the psychopathic perpetrators at the command and control level are satanic child molesters and things of that sort, you can be pretty sure that such people exercise their power at a distance. They play at the level of war and global conflict, and their victims are not allowed to come into contact with them, except, as I say, possibly in these rare cases of individual victims who might be brought to them for their sadistic delights. So I respect the Robert De Niro character in Cape Fear more than I respect, say, someone like Henry Kissinger, as far as respecting psychopaths is concerned, because at least the De Niro character faces and confronts his victims directly. Another correction or qualification from NAB Briefing 8. This concerns what I was saying about the ultimate threat to this experiment, to this divine experiment on the planet Earth. You might be surprised and in some ways dissatisfied or even disappointed by my conclusions on that. A number of you had written me, I think at least maybe a dozen people wrote me at the NAV address giving your views of what is the ultimate threat. And all of those views have a value to them. The ultimate threat to the divine experiment on this planet can be seen in different ways. So in one respect, it is the master race ideology of Zionism. That ideology, as you know, had its roots in the Abrahamic religion, stemming from about 2000 BC, and within the cover of Abrahamic religion, there is the even deeper root of the Melchizedek complex. And this Melchizedek complex of biblical times has morphed into transhumanism in our time. And that is the Zadokite ideology alive and well today, the ideology of the perfect and the righteous. And it is a psychosis from which many of the globalist predators are suffering. And even those who don't suffer from that psychosis, those who don't believe in the Zadokite / transhumanist agenda with themselves at the pinnacle, use that agenda and use that belief system to control and manipulate others. So the ideology of transhumanism, and which is the master race ideology that unfortunately people who call themselves Jews are all implicated in, could well be considered the ultimate threat, and I could name a few other things as well. Why then do I choose to designate that the ultimate threat to this experiment is the combination of paranoia, that is the human capacity for pretending, with a biophobic strain? Well, because that characterization is drawn directly from the parameters of the experiment as we understand it on Sophia's own terms. Now, let me explain for a moment precisely what I mean by that. One of the wonderful advantages, one of the fantastic advantages of the Sophianic Vision story is that it describes the calibration of the human genome. Now, the details of the 7-part calibration of the Anthropos belong to FGS 2.0, to the elaboration and extrapolation of the Fallen Goddess scenario from its initial version 1.0. The version 1.0 of the Fallen Goddess scenario is just a restoration. It's a scholarly feat of restoration based on existing and known materials. As you know, it has in it only one particular element of the Turton's innovation, you could say, one particular addition from the Turton that is not contained in the received textual materials, that being that the Anthropos template, when it was projected from the pleuromic core was deposited in the Orion Nebula. That happens to be an astronomical detail which is not found in the received material. But by and large, almost to 95%, you could say, FGS 1.0, which you find on metahistory.org and in Not in His Image, is a faithful, careful, and meticulous restoration of the existing fragmentary materials of the Sophianic vision story. FGS 2.0 is an extrapolation, and one of the elements of the extrapolation occurs in episode 4, episodes 2, 3, and 4, actually, concerning the way that the human genome, the Anthropos, was calibrated by Sophia and Thelete. And that additional material, that expansion of the sacred narrative, tells us that perinoia was one of the factors in the calibration, and that we as a species, the human animal as a species, was given a very, very high dose of perinoic ability, that is, masking, pretending, make-believe. And the good side, the wonderful side of that, is that it has been, that faculty has been demonstrated vastly through both so-called low culture, that is to say indigenous cultures, where we see it demonstrated in mask and dance and play and theater, and so-called high cultures, which is a way of referring to cultural activity of the human animal that comes through gifted individuals rather than through a tribal or community instrument. So, great works of art, great works of literature like Moby Dick by Melville, great films like films of Federico Fellini or other great masterpieces of art and literature and poetry are expressions of human perinoia. But when that pretending and make-believe faculty combines with fear, then we have the ultimate threat to this experiment understood within the terms of the experiment itself, within the initial conditions of it, we could say, as those conditions were established by the Aeon, Sophia, and Thelete. Just want to point that out. Also would like to correct, finally, one thing I said in that briefing was that I said that it is easy to end pretending, and I used the example of my experience in which someone who was pretending to be in love with me suddenly called cut in her head, and then she was no longer pretending. Well, I need to qualify that a little more closely, and I find that this qualification can be extremely helpful in looking ruthlessly at human behavior. And that would include looking ruthlessly at your own behavior. But remember, if you do that, or when you do that, that one of the primary watchwords from our dear mother, Kali, is be ruthless in self-love. So while you may be advised to be ruthless with yourself in order to come to the truth of your own experience and therefore be more faithful to yourself, at the same time, never allow that ruthfulness to be hurtful to yourself, but practice it as an act of self-love. This is something that I've learned the hard way, but now it's easy. And I see others learning it as well. Kundri's learning it right now, and she's learning it
at a high level of accomplishment, I must say. Anyway, the remark I made in that previous briefing was I said it's easy to end pretending. I was thinking, of course, about how when the voice in one's head yells cut, and then the pretending is over. But to be more comprehensive, it's not easy to end pretending for a lot of people. And the reason for that, what keeps people in pretending, what enmeshes them in pretending, can be described in a single word of five letters. And that word is drama. So when you look at situations in life around you and you see that people are pretending, which they do out of the default position of not knowing what they really want. This is a Kalika teaching, by the way. Unless you know your true desire, you will, by default, fall into pretending. So when you observe this pretending happening around you, you will see, obviously and universally, that the games of pretending and the intimate level in family, in society, and all the way up to through the social levels to the global or planetary level of pretending, you will see that this behavior of make-believe is attended by enormous trauma. And trauma is addictive. Drama is a kind of drug. And so it adds another element of danger to the ultimate danger I'm attempting to deconstruct here, the ultimate danger that we in the experiment are attempting to deconstruct and to liberate ourselves from. But the good news is that when you come to the end of pretending, you have no more drama in your life. No drama at all. And this is an amazing experience to live without drama. Doesn't mean that you don't have intensity and beauty, and that you don't have richly vibrant emotional experiences and moments of vibrancy. Yeah, I must use that word. You have vibrancy of your emotional life, but no drama. It's absolutely remarkable to get to that point. And this happens when you come out of the mesh of the enmeshment and the entrapments, which are multiple, of pretending and make-believe, and enter the clear, sober, and clean air of self-honesty. And in that air, there is no drama. Dramas are really boring. Dramas do not have to happen. Dramas are unnecessary. And I can say with great confidence that one of the marks of the life of someone living in correction is that they have high vivacity and vibrancy of experience at every moment, but no dramas. And that dramas are boring and they don't catch on anymore. You achieve a kind of immunity to drama. So when I said it is easy to end pretending, that is not true for the great majority of the human animals walking around on this planet, to the extent that they are enmeshed in and attached to their dramas, which are primarily sexual dramas, dramas of relationship, dramas of intimacy, dramas of consanguinity, of blood relations, dramas of social relations, dramas of national, cultural, and racial relations and national and cultural and racial identity. The individual who lives vibrantly in the Gaian navigation story, in the Sophianic myth, and who draws upon the sacred power of that myth, is completely liberated from all those dramas. And what a relief that is. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to point out that distinction. I think you can see immediately how helpful it is. Participation in Sophia's story and in her experiment on her terms means non-participation in the charade and the lies in which the vast, vast majority of human animals are enmeshed. So on that topic or theme of drama, might be a good place to segue to the second part of this briefing. In the second part, I would like to give some directions and share with you my sense of the key factors in the navigation that's now unfolding as we come to the midpoint of correction. And doing so, I would ask you this question. We all know what dramas are. We've had dramas with people. Let's just start and talk and think for a minute about some personal drama. My affair with Emma was a huge personal drama, okay? All of you have had love affairs and marriages, relationships, and the beginning, middle, and ends of these experiences have been loaded with drama. I think you'd all agree on that, wouldn't you? Now suppose I put this question to you. Expanding and expanding, expanding beyond the realm of your intimate life, in your personal life, and your sexual relationships or family relationships, expanding beyond all that, how far out does the wave of drama go? What is the biggest drama that you could ever be involved in? What is the biggest drama that any human animal could ever experience? Well, interesting question there. Fun to think about that. But I would propose to you that the answer is simple and obvious. The biggest drama of any human animal is to be involved in the fate of humanity. One of the ways that that drama has been hallucinated itself, I should say, one of the ways in which that drama has hallucinated itself out of the human psyche over the centuries is in the image of course, the Day of Judgment, the apocalypse, the end of the world. All of this chatter and all of these fantastic claims and speculations on the internet about the year 2012 is a huge drama in which the individual who engages in that speculation becomes a participant. The notion that you can be a participant or that you inevitably must be a participant in the fate of humanity is the hugest drama in the world. And it is also an enormous setup. It's an enormous trap. You come to the end of humanity when you come to the place in yourself where you choose not to be dramatically caught up in the fate of humanity, when you realize in absolutely clear and sober terms that you have an option. Now that option is called sorcery. I've pointed out before on a number of occasions, a number of talks I've given over the years, that the word sorcery comes from the French root, a medieval French root, sor, S-O-R-S, which is a very ancient word, and it's equivalent to the Latin word fatum, meaning fate. Your sort in French is your fate. But curiously, the French verb sortir means to leave or go away. So in close analysis, the word sorcery, which is derived from sort and sortir, means to go away from something, to go away from fate. And what is the fate that you go away from? It is the fate of being blindly and dramatically enmeshed in the human condition. Sorcery is departure from the human condition. And I speak those words as someone who has made that departure. And I advise you all, out of my love for humanity and for the humanity in you, to consider that you could separate yourself from the fate of humanity at large. That is the supreme act of sorcery. Now, Don Juan told Carlos that sorcery is the act of breaking the parameters of perception. And when the Spanish poet Federico García Lorca wrote his magnificent essay on the duende, he described the duende in a number of ways, including to say, the duende smashes all the forms. And one of the forms it smashes, I might add, is the mold of humanity, is the form of the human conditioning that makes a human animal place themselves in the fold of humanity. Castaneda also spoke, or Don Juan, we could say, the alter ego of Castaneda, also spoke in really intimate and rigorous terms and in hilarious terms, as far as I'm concerned, about this issue. You might recall once that Carlos had this transcendent, sublime vision when he was in some altered state. I described this and not in his image. And it's very probable that he saw the etheric Christ, which is the plasmic afterimage of the Christos Aeon that still resonates and resides in the atmosphere of the earth, and mistook it, as people often do, for a divine being or for a divine apotheosis of the human being, as Christos is generally considered. And so Carlos was shaken and moved and thought he had seen the most beautiful thing in the world. Oh, I've seen the Christhood of humanity. What could be greater than that? And he came back to Don Juan and, told him what he had seen. And the old shaman, the old Nahual, chuckled and shook his head and looked at him and said, hey, that's what sorcerers call the mold of man. And it's just an illusion. And in sorcery, we lose the human form. We shatter the mold of the human. This is what Don Juan said to Carlos on that memorable occasion. And it's more or less what I'm saying to you now. So bear that thought in mind for a moment and allow me to take your hand And as you're considering what I just said, take your hand and bring you over into my cinematic world for a moment, because I am, of course, as you might know, a screenwriter. And I had the occasion in 2002 to write my first screenplay, which is based on the life of Sabina Spielrein, who was the first mistress of C.G. Jung. And this is a true story. Her life story is absolutely astounding. I researched it for 9 years, and then beginning in 1993, and then in 2002, I wrote a screenplay about Sabina. And I'd like to present you with scene 37 in this screenplay, or scene 38. This is a scene in which Jung and Sabina are talking at the time when she has enrolled. She's about 19, he's 29, 10 years older than her. He's married to the richest woman, one of the richest women in Switzerland, Emma Jung, and is beginning to have a family. But he is deeply enthralled and enmeshed with this young Russian woman, Sabina, who is his student, his protege, and who is an absolute genius. And during the time that she enters medical school, she is still in therapy with Jung, as it were. So she meets him in his office several times a week, and they talk. And this is one of the conversations that they have. Sabina, do you believe that everyone has a guardian spirit? She approaches the desk where Jung sits and sits down beside him. Jung, how different the world might be if it were so. The guardian may be there, but not everyone can detect its presence, much less respond to it. Sabina, it helps to give it a name. I call mine Wanderer. Jung, but that comes from Nietzsche. You must have read Zarathustra. Wanderer is the name he uses to address himself, or his higher spirit, the Übermensch. It's the part of him that is always pushing beyond the horizon, beyond what is known and established, beyond good and evil. Sabina, well, I wouldn't say my guardian is like that exactly. But then I've never read Nietzsche. Jung, you haven't? But this cannot be a mere coincidence. Excited, Jung goes to the bookcase and takes down a volume. Sabina, perhaps our wanderers cross paths, Nietzsche's and mine. Jung, nodding thoughtfully at her remark as he riffles a book. When I was young, I felt the calling of the Superman. Nietzsche was a crucial influence for me. His words could arouse my soul like no others, and still do. Jung reads from the book. You look up when you desire to be exalted, and I look down because I am exalted. Who among you can at the same time laugh and be exalted? Whoever climbs the highest mountains laughs at all tragedies, real or imaginary. Returning to his desk, Jung hands her the book. Jung, I remember how Zarathustra argues with a saint who has rejected the world. He declares that he loves humanity, but the saint warns him that love of humanity will destroy him. I was deeply troubled by this argument. Sabina, offhandedly looking at the book. Oh, I think that love of one person must be enough to destroy someone. Imagine what love of humanity can do. So there you have a little glimpse of the screenplay called Sabina, which was written 10 years ago. And rereading it now myself, I see how apt it is for the subject under consideration. You know, I've talked a lot about this Emma story because it is the generative legend of planetary tantra. And I've always stressed the fact that planetary tantra, which is a transpersonal vision and practice, came into the world through a particular personal situation. It wasn't given by angels and seraphim out of the clouds. It didn't come by channeling. It came out of the catastrophic emotional experience that one man had with one woman. And what was it exactly that triggered that catastrophic, life-threatening trauma, which, when it got turned around, turned into planetary tantra? What was it? Simple. The woman refused his love. Now, consider that. Consider that love, your love, can be refused. I can tell you this really does happen. Happened to me. Consider that your love erupting like a warm stream of lava from your heart, were it offered to someone, can be refused. Now I'm talking about the intimate and personal dimension of things. Now I'm saying one woman refuses the love of one man. One man refuses the love of one woman. But take it to the ultimate. Take it to the ultimate case. Suppose you took your love to humanity and humanity refused your love. Well, I'm here to tell you that that's exactly what it's going to do. Because humanity is finished. And what has finished it is a complex aggregation of factors. Okay, let's admit that. But what has really finished it, probably centrally at the core, is that the human animal cannot receive love. I want you to think about this. This is the end of humanity. It's the place, the moment in time, in history, when the human animal cannot receive love. I'm not talking about the ability to give love. I'm talking about the ability to receive it. I am so pleased with my screenplay about Sabina. Not only because I had a fantastic time writing it, not only because I love Sabina Spielrein as if she were a woman that was in my life physically today, not only because I have her under my skin, and she's an adorable genius, but because I was able to show, am able to show, in certain episodes of that screenplay, certain truths about the human condition. And you'll note in that little episode, in that scene, how you see Jung in his inflation, you see the male in his inflation. I mean, it's a sincere and it's a genuine inflation, but it's an inflation. So there is Jung with his inflation of Nietzsche and the Übermensch, the Superman, which he sees in a very idealistic way, of course. And how cleverly and how skillfully Sabina burst his bubble. So I could say that I'm sort of playing Sabina to you right now, folks, and I'm going to burst your bubble. But then to speak, let's say, less presumptuously, it's not me who's bursting your bubble. But it may well be that your bubbles are bursting. I'd like to just read to you a couple of lines from an email I got today from a crew member. He says, John, after listening to tonight's navigation briefing, I've decided to send you a song called For Emma, Forever Ago by artist Bon Iver. And he gives me the link to the song. And he says, I feel it suiting for this time now, as you have decided to note upon love and the tearing from the human condition. In late 2009, I experienced this tearing and ripping from the human condition as a result of a complete trust and love for another human animal, a woman. She tore this condition from me, and I am only thankful, for she introduced me to my own true love, the divine Sophia. And this message is signed, a dangerous protector. So I'm happy indeed and lucky indeed to have dangerous protectors like that in this experiment with me. And how wonderful it is when I find a message like that in my inbox. So there it is. And in this adventure, there is a discovery of love unlike anything one may have known before. Why is that? It's very simple. It's so simple and elementary. That's only your connection to the living transpersonal can free the immense power of love that lives in you. Only that connection frees it, as is so beautifully said in this message. Do you know that if we go back to my indications on the wheel of compassion, that there were six spokes. One of them is the polarity of love and indifference. It's the opposite of love is not hatred, my friends. It's indifferent. And the more you love, and the more you surrender to your capacity to love, and the more the sacred power of love awakens in you through the transpersonal bond to the earth, the more indifferent you can be to many, many things. And that indifference is a beautiful indifference. It's a serenity, and it's a just and fair and even-tempered indifference. If you can love, you're free not to love. If you really care, you're free not to care. What then about hatred, which is usually considered to be the opposite of love? I made some strong remarks about hatred. Just let me qualify them in the last few moments of this briefing. What then can be said about hatred? What is the role of hatred in this adventure, in this immense process of correction? What is the role of hatred? If I'm separating from the human condition, why would I hate anyone who's still in that condition? Well, let's recall hatred in its polarity with generosity. You see, this is the kicker. This is the kicker, you know? The opposite of hatred is not love, but generosity. And love and generosity go together, though, don't they? So when you feel that power of love in yourself, that sacred upwelling, coming with it, flowing with it, is the natural generosity of the human animal, something we share with the aeons. The main signature of divine beings is generosity. The natural generosity of the human animal is to want to give your love. But I warn you and advise you that humanity in its current state may not be able to receive it. And so the hatred felt toward humanity that I felt since I was a teenager is not a dark, vicious, nasty, mean kind of emotion. It's just a cold reckoning of the point of difference. We are not all one. That is an illusion as much as the illusion of separation. There's a way I behave, and there's a way I don't behave. And there's a way others behave, and I don't behave like that. And hatred makes that distinction. Hatred holds that distinction. Could you hurt a 10-year-old child? I couldn't. And I hate anyone who can and does. So when I spoke of hatred, I meant it in that sense. It's a kind of responsibility that comes with the natural generosity of the human animal. It's a force of perception and discernment. Hatred is a power of discrimination, and it has huge protective properties. Hatred is that by which a human animal defines its territory, the territory where love can live and survive and thrive. This is what I mean by hatred. So don't be afraid to hate. Don't be afraid of that feeling. Accept it, but view it soberly and lucidly. View it with the highest lucidity and recognize that it's probably necessary for your survival in a world in which humanity has come to its end.